This evening we want to cover Genesis 8 and 9, which tells us something of the aftermath of the flood. You'll recall that the rain lasted for 40 days and 40 nights, and then there was an additional time before the waters began to recede, and this totaled 150 days. So that by the time that 150 days had passed, the waters had begun to recede, and the ark came to rest in the mountains of Ararat. Now you'll notice that the text says that the resting of the ark was in the mountains of Ararat. We are not talking about a single peak, Mount Ararat, but we are talking about an area which is referred to as the mountains of Ararat. And we would assume that what the text is telling us here is that in the area which today we refer to as the mountains of Ararat. Then the waters continued to abate, continued to recede until the 10th month of Noah's life. In the first day of that month, the 10th month of the 600th year of his life, in the 10th month, the first day, the tops of the mountains could be seen as Noah and his children looked out of the ark. You can imagine the feeling that the family of Noah had as they looked out and now no longer saw water, but were able to see the tops of the mountains. You can well imagine, too, that Noah and his family was anxious to get off the ark. They had probably had enough of the water. They had probably had enough of the rocking that came as the ark moved along the waters. We can be quite sure that it was not just like a little boat in a bathtub, but that there were currents, and it must have been a rather rough ride as they traveled back and forth across the open water. So they were very happy that now, although the ark was caught on Mount Ararat, or one of the mountains of the area, now they could themselves see the tops of the mountains. The impression we have is that where the ark was caught was on one of the highest peaks, and it had gone aground here. It took a while for other mountains to become visible, and we can well imagine that Noah was anxious to see land once more. He waited 40 days after the tops of the mountains became visible, and then opened the window of the ark and sent out a raven. Probably wasn't the best choice for what he had in mind. He had in mind some determination of the condition of the land. The raven is a carrion feeder, and no doubt found plenty of food available. It feeds on dead bodies and so was well able to take care of itself. It doesn't need too much of an area in which to land, and probably by this time there were enough places for it to rest. Moreover, it could probably rest on some of the floating debris. So the raven never came back. The impression that we have is that Noah then recognized that he had not made too good a choice, and now he decided that he would try a dove. The dove is a vegetarian, and consequently would have to find vegetable matter. It would be an indication that the vegetation was growing once more, and would be an indication that the land was returning to its previous state. The dove flew back and forth, was unable to find an adequate landing place, no doubt couldn't find food, and so decided that she would like to return to the ark. Noah then permitted the bird to come back, waited 7 more days, sent her out, and now she comes back with a freshly plucked olive leaf in her mouth. an indication that the vegetation was growing once more. So Noah now knows that the waters have retreated enough for an olive tree to start growing, and apparently enough time had passed that not only was the olive tree starting to grow, but it had put forth some leaves. Noah knew that the earth was now able once more to sustain life. Now, he waits a little bit longer. He isn't anxious to go out, but he waits a little bit longer and waits until the face of the ground is dry. The impression we have is that prior to this time, the water had retreated. There was dry land around, but it must have been just a mass of mud. Now, however, when he looks out, he can find that there is enough dry land around that normal pursuits would be possible. The most important thing, though, to Noah is God's command. The Lord God says to him, "Go out from the ark. Take your wife and your sons and their wives with them, and not only your family, but also the animals that you brought aboard the ark, they're to go out so that they may breed abundantly and be fruitful and multiply." So they are to be a sort of a seed for the future. They are here in, they've been preserved in order that the world may be repopulated once more. And things move out of the ark. What's very interesting is that Noah expresses his thankfulness by building an altar. He is grateful to God. He recognizes that what he owes to God, realizes that God has been very good to him in preserving him, something that he didn't deserve. Certainly Noah had no claim on righteousness, could not claim that he was perfect and the others were all evil. God had been good to him. It was God's grace to him that enabled him to survive. It was not something that Noah deserved, because Noah was a human being with human faults and failings, just as we all are. But at least he worshiped God. And God, in his grace, then decided that he should survive. Now, Noah then expresses his thankfulness by building an altar and offering sacrifices of the clean animals and the clean birds. God is happy. He appreciates this. We're told the Lord smelled the pleasing odor. He was glad that Noah showed the grace of thankfulness. And I think this is something that we need to keep in mind. It's a grace, a Christian grace, to be thankful. We do receive a great many things from God. And as you know, God does not withhold daily bread from the wicked. He doesn't cause the rain to stop when it comes to the fences which mark the borders of the land owned by the man who is faithful to him. But the rain falls on the fields of both the just and the unjust. And as Luther tells us in the fourth petition, God gives daily bread indeed without a prayer also to all the wicked. But we pray in this petition that he may lead us to know it and to receive our daily bread with thanksgiving. So even in the Lord's Prayer, we are really asking God to give us the grace of being thankful. And it is this grace which Noah expressed here when he offered up sacrifices, and it was this grace which was so pleasing to God. God now takes this as a sign of Noah's thankfulness and expresses his appreciation. He says, "I will not never again curse the ground because of man. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, shall not cease." Now, one thing that is interesting here is that if you compare this phrase at the end of the eighth chapter, "while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. If you compare that with the statement in the first chapter of Genesis with regard to the role of the heavenly bodies, we're told there that they are to be for signs and for seasons, for days and years. So there were seasons, you might say, prior to this time. But here you have the first reference to cold and heat, to summer and winter. There are many people who believe that prior to the flood, you did not have the sharp distinction of the seasons that we have, where you have summer and winter and cold and heat. There may well have been seasons, and there probably were seasons. We can imagine that the trees lost their leaves at certain times, and that there were perhaps seasons of more precipitation, although, as I indicated, I don't think it rained, and less precipitation. There were seasons, but not summer and winter, cold and heat. So now for the first time you have the mention of the summer and winter, cold and heat. We go on then to the ninth chapter, and here we have a number of things that we want to comment upon. In the first place, we have the blessing which God spoke to Noah and his sons, the command to be fruitful and multiply, to fill the earth. This is a repetition, of course, of the command that was given to our first parents, where they were told to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. This, of course, was not only a command, but it was also an empowering statement. God not only commanded them to be fruitful and multiply, but by this statement and by his blessing, he gave them the ability to have children and to fill the earth. You notice that man is to rule over the earth. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the air. So man is to be the foremost of the visible creatures. Man is to rule over the earth. Now that does not mean that he is to exploit it. There are a great many people today who suggest that because man is to rule over the earth, he has the right to exploit the earth. He has the right to wipe out plants. He has the right to wipe out animals. But that's not what is meant here. Man is to be the steward. God is the creator, and therefore God is the owner. And man is only the steward. He has no right to take actions with regard to those things which he does not own, because he hasn't made them. So while man is to be supreme, he is to rule over the earth. That does not mean that he has a right to exploit. It does not mean that he has a right to wipe out other creatures. It's rather interesting that throughout the scriptures we're told that God cares not only for man, but also for the creatures. We're told that not a sparrow falls to the ground without God's knowledge. And if God pays that much attention to the sparrows, then certainly he must care for them. He must attach some value to them. And we're told that God supplies food to both man and beast. It isn't only man who receives food, but also the beasts of the field. So it isn't quite right to say that because man is the foremost of the visible creatures, and because he is to rule over the earth, that means that he has a right to exploit. He doesn't. He's only the caretaker, the steward. It is God who owns all of this, and we need to be particularly aware of that today when we are faced with so many environmental crises. There's another thing that's very interesting here. We're told now that every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I give you the green plants, I give you everything. You have to go back again to the first chapter of Genesis, where we're told that to every beast of the earth and to every bird of the air and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. There are many people who, in the light of this comparison, hold that prior to the flood, man was a vegetarian. And I'm inclined to agree with that. It seems to me that prior to the flood, God wanted man to eat only vegetable matter. Here, there is obviously a change in his diet, because we're told here that every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. So here's a change. It is not simply that the same diet is to be continued, but now man is to eat meat. I believe then that it was not until after the flood that man became omnivorous in the sense that he eats both vegetable matter and meat. There is one thing that here already we are told is to be omitted from the diet. Only you shall not eat the flesh with its life, that is, its blood. It's very interesting, because today we would certainly acknowledge that of all the tissues, the blood is certainly a very important one, perhaps even the most important one. We can continue to live without any tissue except blood. We've got to have the blood in order to carry oxygen. And as soon as the blood ceases to circulate, all of the tissues die. In one sense, we'd say the brain is the most important, because the brain directs the activities of the organism. And yet, in another sense, the blood is even more important, because the blood carries the oxygen which nourishes all the tissues. So God here says, you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. Already at this point, something which was incorporated into the Mosaic law, they were not to eat blood. And what God seems to have in mind here is this. He does not want them to fall on meat as an animal and eat it before the blood has drained out. He doesn't want them to be so anxious to eat that they can't wait until the blood has drained out of the animal that they're going to consume. They're not to be ravenous, but they are to eat the meat after there has been a time for it to cure, until they're to wait until the blood has drained out. As you may know, there are some people who insist on the basis of this verse, and then also the verses later on which forbid the eating of blood, that a blood transfusion is improper. You know that the Jehovah's Witnesses believe that accepting a blood transfusion is the equivalent of eating blood. And from time to time, we have cases in court of where members of Jehovah's Witnesses are insistent that they receive no blood transfusion. Now, certainly an adult has a right for himself to refuse a transfusion, but where this becomes a case for the courts is where minors are involved or others are involved. The courts have generally held that parents do not have a right to forbid their children to receive a transfusion, even though the children may consent. Courts generally have held that the minors are not in a position to make that decision, and the usual legal procedure has been to appoint a guardian who then orders the transfusion. So very interesting cases that have come up lately are instances where a pregnant woman has refused a blood transfusion because she was a member of Jehovah's Witnesses, and then the courts have ordered her to receive it in order to protect her unborn child. And there's even a case on record where a young mother with young children refused a blood transfusion, and she was ordered to take it, to accept it, because the judge ruled that her young children needed her, and that if she did not receive this blood transfusion, she might very well succumb. Now, another very interesting thing here is the verse to which we alluded a couple of evenings ago. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image. We pointed to this in connection with the banishment of Cain. And we commented that there are many people who believe that capital punishment is required by the scriptures on the basis of this verse. Now, it is true, of course, that this verse does permit capital punishment. And as I commented at that time, I believe that this verse gives the government the right to take the life of the murderer, or to take the life of a man who has committed some very serious crime. I do not believe that it requires that the government take his life. So it seems to me that the matter of capital punishment is a matter for political decision. I think that in our country and in under our governmental system, the people themselves need to decide. It's not obligatory, but it is permissive. We go on then to the next verses, which record the covenant through the rainbow. Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, "Behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your descendants forever. And the covenant is that never again will all flesh be cut off by the waters of a flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth." Then God goes on to describe the sign of this covenant. "I set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and all the earth." So here, the rainbow is established as the sign of God's covenant. Now, the covenant is this, that no more will there be a flood which will destroy all living things. As St. Peter says, next time by fire. The next world destruction is to come at the end of the earth's existence, when our Lord comes to judge the quick and the dead, and then the destruction will be by fire. Now, one question that arises in this connection is about the rainbow. Are we to believe that there was no rainbow prior to the flood? We would all agree that the rainbow is a physical phenomenon. It occurs when light is broken up, refracted or broken up, when it passes through tiny prisms such as the drops of water in a rainstorm, so that you would expect a rainbow to occur following every storm as the sunlight is broken up by the droplets of water. There are two possibilities. The one possibility is that the rainbow had always existed. It had been there, but now it is to be the sign of the covenant. Now, as soon as people see the rainbow, they are to recognize that this is the sign of God's promise that the earth will never again be destroyed by flood. So it's possible that the rainbow was there all along. But from now on, it's to be a sign of God's covenant with his people. And, of course, it's something which is associated with rain, and the rain would remind people of the flood. The other possibility, and this is the one that I'm inclined to accept, is that there had been no rain prior to the flood. I mentioned this earlier. I'm inclined to believe that prior to the flood, the earth was watered by this mist. And if it were watered by a mist, there would have been no rainbow. So what I'm suggesting is that when Noah and his sons came off the ark and they saw for the first time a rainbow, they must have been very much impressed. And I think you can imagine what a striking thing it would be to see this beautiful rainbow, something which you had never seen before. And now God says, fine, that is the covenant, the sign of the covenant, that I will never again destroy the earth by water. So I'm inclined to believe that this was the first time they had seen the rainbow and it was now the sign of the covenant. Now, the last part of this chapter is a very unfortunate episode, reports a very unfortunate episode. We have Noah becoming drunk. We have the ridicule that was heaped upon him by Ham and probably by Canaan, and the curse then on Canaan. We're told that Noah planted a vineyard, drank of the wine, and became drunk. There are some people who suggest that as a result of the changes which took place following the flood, wine or grape juice now for the first time fermented. They believe that prior to this time, there were none of the bacteria which bring about fermentation. And they suggest that Noah didn't know anything about the possibility of grape juice fermenting. I suspect that these are people who are somewhat defensive of Noah. They like to believe that he's a fine example of a Christian, and they don't like to believe that he would fall into this sin. I suspect, too, that these are people who are somewhat, let's say, Methodistic or pietistic in their approach. They regard drunkenness as a very serious sin, and they're sort of defensive of Noah. They don't like to believe that he could have gotten drunk if he had known any better. So their suggestion is that the bacteria which bring about fermentation were new, and that now, for the first time, Noah unwittingly had partaken of an alcoholic beverage, didn't know how to handle it, and got drunk. I don't think it's necessary to accept that account. I think it would be difficult, really, to suggest that now, for the first time, you had these bacteria which change grape juice to wine. And I can conceive of Noah just drinking and not learning to stop in time, drinking too much and becoming drunk. The point is that he lay here naked, and his son, Ham, seems to have been the one who took the leadership in ridiculing him. We're told that Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. The impression we have here is that he ridiculed his father, made fun of him, talked in jest about the old man who had drunk too much, and there he had taken off all his clothes, gotten hot, and had just laid down without any clothes on. In any case, Shem and Japheth show more respect for their father. They take a garment and lay it on their shoulders, walk backwards, cover him up, and in that way protect him against ridicule. One of the problems in this connection is that it is Canaan who is cursed. It isn't Ham, but it is Canaan. Canaan, you'll recall, is the father of the Canaanites. These are the people whom the children of Israel expelled from the Holy Land. They found them living there when they moved into Palestine. This is their father, Canaan. But why should Canaan be cursed for the sin of Ham? Now, there are several possibilities. We don't know what all of the circumstances were. I don't think that we need to accept that this particular episode occurred immediately after the flood. I have the impression, from the very fact that you have Canaan around, that some time had elapsed, some years had elapsed, and that a number of children had been born. So I think that there was a crowd around, as it were. The picture I have is that Canaan went around to his cousins, and he ridiculed his grandfather, and perhaps was even sharper in his criticisms than was Ham. So I suspect that Canaan was involved, and that the criticisms that he uttered were perhaps even sharper than the criticisms which were uttered by Ham, and that this is the reason for the curse on Canaan. One other possibility is that Noah did not want to curse his own son, which would reflect on him, but that he didn't have scruples about cursing his grandson, and this would then reflect on the father Ham. But in any case, we have here the curse on Canaan that he is to be the slave.